I thought I would just review a little bit from yesterday and then continue on, so we complete the topic of how to rely on a spiritual mentor, and then from there go on into the topic of making the Dharma your own, if we get that far. But in any case, no matter what we talk about, we're still in the process of making the Dharma our own, aren't we? So yesterday I talked about different levels of people who help us on the path. And, you know, there might be people who are academic scholars, people who teach us meditation, and senior students who lead an introductory Dharma course. And these people aren't really Dharma teachers. They're people who help us on the path, and we appreciate them for the help they give. But they aren't really the Dharma teachers that we're going to rely on, you know, expecting them to lead us to higher states of realization. So among the teachers that we really count on to lead us on the path, we spoke of three levels of teachers. The Vinaya teacher, who is the person that we take refuge from, that we take five precepts from, and who teaches us the basic Buddhist framework of the Four Noble Truths and what is samsara, how we get out of samsara. And then the second is the Mahayana teacher, the person who teaches us the Mahayana path that leads to full enlightenment. And so that person will teach us the far-reaching attitudes, the paramitas. They'll give us the Bodhisattva vows, teach us more about the Prasangika Majjhimika view of emptiness. And then finally, the Tantric or Vajrayana master, who gives us Tantric initiation and instructions on the Tantric path. Okay, so those are three levels of teachers. And yesterday I went through the various qualifications for each level, although I didn't elaborate on the qualifications for the Tantric master. I just gave those in a very abbreviated way. Okay? So that's basically what we spent most of yesterday talking about, didn't we? And then I told some stories, and you all went, ah! And, okay. So, I thought it would be good to talk a little bit more about, you know, what are the advantages and benefits of having a spiritual mentor. So yesterday I was saying, you know, if we need somebody to teach us how to type and somebody else to how to drive, then since attaining enlightenment is a little bit more difficult than those, we certainly need somebody to teach us the path to enlightenment. And we need to learn it from someone who has a reliable lineage tracing back to the Buddha. Okay, not somebody who made up a path last week and is marketing it in the Times today. Okay, but a path that is tried and true for many centuries that we can really have faith and confidence in because we've seen that it's produced highly realized masters. Okay, we also talked yesterday about how it's our decision about who we choose as a teacher, that nobody tells us that they're our teacher or that we have to be their student, that we're the ones who are responsible for checking their qualifications and making that connection, and that we can certainly take our time in doing it. Okay? So that all has to do with the benefit of having a teacher, because you want to really have somebody that you can trust over a period of time, because then you can reap the advantages of having a spiritual teacher. No, in the scriptures, there's many lists of the advantages of having a teacher, the disadvantages of having an improper relationship with a teacher. Okay. And he's fine. So the teacher's job is to give us teachings and to give us spiritual guidance and spiritual counsel. As we talked yesterday, the teacher's job is not to meet out all of our emotional needs. And if we have a close relationship with the teacher, then we're able to learn the teachings well, and we have a constant source of inspiration in our practice. You know, because some people say, well, can't the scriptures be our teacher? You know, if I get transcripts from a course that was taught somewhere else and read the transcripts, aren't I following a spiritual mentor? Don't I get the same kind of results? I don't think so. That hasn't been my experience. Okay, I think there's something that's very precious that happens when you have a live teacher that you don't get when you read a book. Okay, the books are very good to use as a resource after we've studied with a teacher, or before we've studied with a teacher when we're still trying to learn the basic Buddhist principles and figure out what Buddhism is and who we may want to go study with. But if we just rely on books and don't have that living connection, I think we miss out on something. Because I know for myself, the example of how my teachers live their lives is very important. And, you know, I don't necessarily live in the houses with them and see everything they do. And as you can see, I'm not always with my teachers. I'm sometimes several thousand miles away. But at least in the beginning, I spent a great deal of time around my teachers. And I could watch and see how they handle different situations. And that became a Dharma teaching in and of itself. You know, there was the formal teaching, and what I learned as they went through, you know, the outlines of the long rim and thought training. But then in seeing how they practiced it in their own lives, that was something that was very important for me. You know, how they dealt with real life situations. And you see, that's something you can never get from a book, because a book isn't a living being. So, just to give you one example, you know, we can study a lot about, in the thought training or Lojong teachings, about cultivating patience and how, you know, the person who is suffering a lot and who is very obnoxious is like our spiritual mentor. And, you know, we study it and we say, oh, yes, 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 you know. And, oh, yes, I'm very patient with everybody. Until somebody comes along like that. Yeah. And then we forget everything we heard, and we can't figure out even how to practice it if we do remember it. Because this person is so entirely obnoxious, how could you ever see them as anything but that? Okay? So I remember one situation. Happened many years ago, and there were two Chinese nuns who had come with me to India and Nepal. It was their first exposure to Tibetan Buddhism in those countries. And I arranged for them to have lunch with my teacher. And, you know, it's hard to have lunch with my teacher. He's quite busy. He has many disciples. And so I was very pleased that he actually had time to meet with these two Chinese nuns. So we go up, you know, to his private dining room, and we sit, and we're just starting the meal. And this person comes in, okay? Now, the person who comes in, I had worked with him before at a Dharma center. Yeah, it isn't Sam. But it is Sam's, what do you call it? Clone, yes. Okay? So it's, let's give him a name. What are we going to call him? Harry. Okay. So Harry walks in the room. Okay. So I have a history with Harry. You know, he's just as obnoxious as Sam was. Also Italian macho, you know, so just to put it in context with, you know, an American woman, an Italian macho man. And he comes, he just walks in the dining room, and he starts talking to Rinpoche. And Harry had just come from a meeting of, you know, the various Dharma centers. And he comes in the room and he says, Rinpoche, you know, I've been working so long in this organization, and I was at this meeting, and all these people are blaming me for this and that and this and that. And he's telling this whole story, you know, to Rinpoche about how all these other people are criticizing him and treating him so poorly.
And I'm going, yeah, I know why they're criticizing you. I've worked with you. You know, I don't think their criticism is unreal. You know, this wasn't coming out of my mouth. It was in my mind. And I'm thinking, you know, and you're showing how obnoxious you are right now by walking in on Rinpoche's lunch with two foreign guests. You know, and this guy's going on and on and on and on and on and on and dramatic and coming out of the way, and, you know, and I'm going. And Rinpoche is sitting there and just being completely cool and saying, oh, it's okay, Harry, you know, I know how hard you've worked, and you know, you don't need to take it seriously what these people are saying. And I'm going, yes, you do. You really are like that. And Rinpoche's, you know, being so comforting and da 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 da. And this goes on the entire lunch. Okay? So by the time Harry gets done and is ready to leave, our lunch is done and the two guests have not had a chance to talk with Rinpoche, as it's time for us to leave also. So I was not a happy camper about this whole situation. The Chinese nuns were completely cool about it. No complaints, nothing, you know. It was me. And so I had to go back and really think about this. And, like, why is Rinpoche being so kind and compassionate to this idiot? You know, and this was my koan. You know, who says Tibetans don't have koans? You know, this was my koan. But it was really good because it made me see so clearly, yes, this is exactly the meaning of, you know, when there's a person who is suffering and who is obnoxious, how to treat them like your teacher and how to cultivate patience. Because what my mind was doing and what Rinpoche's mind were doing were like opposite ends. So who was the obnoxious one? It was actually me. It was my mind that wasn't practicing Dharma. Okay. But this example of how to practice in that situation with that person, that living example was so important for me to see that it's actually possible. So that kind of thing, you can't get through a book. Okay? Or another situation. No, I mean, just all sorts of things you just learn in daily relationships that you have with your teacher. One time, you know, Lama was traveling around. You know, he had this network of teachings, and he came to where I was. And I had gone to see him about something, and he was asking me, how's this person and how's that person and how's this and that working? And some of the things he asked me about, well, the people weren't doing very well and they were quarreling and, you know, they were more Harry and Sam clones. You know, I seem to know a lot of those people and I wonder why. Lama was asking me about this, but by this time I had figured out that, you know, I shouldn't say bad things about other people to my teacher, and so I was kind of holding back, and I didn't want to say, well, you know, some people were quarreling, or there was a disagreement about this or that, because I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to talk about quarreling and people's bad qualities and stuff like that. And so, but Lama was pressing me, and so I finally said, Lama, you know, in the Tantra vows, it says you're not supposed to talk about the bad qualities and the faults of your Vajra brothers and sisters, and so I don't want to do that. And he said to me, well, you can tell me about what's happening, but without criticizing those people. You know? And that made a strong influence on me. You know, it's like I didn't have to, you know, pretend that nothing was happening. But I also didn't have to put in all my critical, judgmental mind that was angry and hostile and wanted to, you know, use my speech to create disharmony. But instead, you know, he needed information. I had the information. Even though it wasn't pleasant information to relay, it would be possible to do it without having a negative mind and creating negative karma. Okay? So you see, that kind of thing I never could have learned from listening to a teaching. It was like that direct, that relationship, seeing that actually come up in our life together and having Lama give me that advice right then. Okay, so these are just some stories. I could go on and on about, but it's just the value of how you can learn things from watching our teacher's behavior that we can't learn from a book. Yeah, so we can learn a lot intellectually from the book, but something special about the relationship. Also, when we're doing something that is inappropriate, our teacher can point it out to us. A book can't point it out directly. A book points it out in, you know, the teachings, but it's up to us to realize that the book's talking about us. So it's possible to wiggle out of it, you know. But when we're right there in the situation and our teacher looks at us and says, "You seem a little bit angry, don't you?" Then, you know, we have to deal with what's happening at that moment. We can't wiggle out of it. Okay? So just having those situations where, you know, when something's happening, where our spiritual mentor can point out something to us. It's something that comes from having a living person and that relationship that doesn't come from the book. Okay? Similarly, you know, we may think that we're understanding something. We study, you know, Majjhimika philosophy from a book, and we think we've got it all straight. And then our teacher asks us a question, and we're going, oh, you know? And then we realize, hey, actually, I don't understand anything. Okay? But a book can't ask us the question. A living being has to. Okay, so you're getting what I'm saying, kind of the value of having a real live person as our spiritual mentor. And so it's incredibly important to have a good relationship with our various spiritual mentors, and we can have more than one. I think Atisha had 147, you know, so it's, you know, certainly possible to have more than one, but we choose each one of them wisely. Okay, and then it's important to have a good relationship. Why? Because if we develop a negative state of mind towards our teachers, it makes it very easy for us to abandon the Dharma practice and get disillusioned about the Dharma. And if we do that, we're only shooting ourselves in the foot. Okay? And so, for that reason, it's, you know, like I was saying yesterday, it's important to choose our teachers carefully and wisely, and then once we have, to maintain a positive attitude towards them. That doesn't mean that we whitewash difficulties, okay? And it doesn't mean we say, oh yes, everything's fine, when it isn't. Yeah, or if a teacher is not keeping proper ethical discipline, it doesn't mean that we ignore their infractions. Okay? Things have to be dealt with squarely and honestly, without criticism, without hostility. Yeah? But, you know, still it's important to keep an attitude of respect in our mind, because that attitude benefits us in our own practice. Okay? Because, okay, let's say you're studying with somebody for a long time. You have a very good relationship, you know, because we all come into the Dharma. We're very idealistic, aren't we? You know, it's like, finally I found the Dharma. It's so wonderful. Everybody's a Buddha. You know, all these teachers are Buddha. They're so wonderful. They don't do anything wrong. And besides, in the long run, it says to see them as a Buddha, so they must be a Buddha, and I'm in love, you know? And it's nice at the beginning like that. And then, you know, then the honeymoon is over at some point, you know, like it is in any relationship. And our judgmental, critical mind starts going to work. Yeah. And all of a sudden, it's like, well, why does my teacher do that? And why are they saying this? And they shouldn't do that, they should do this. And they aren't treating me properly. And they're teaching this, but they're not, you know, enacting it in their life. And they're doing this, and they're doing that. And then all the finger-pointing starts, okay? Because we're very good at pointing out other people's faults and deficiencies, aren't we? You know, who, me? I don't have any faults and deficiencies. But everybody else does. And now we're starting to project that same stuff onto our teacher. And that becomes very poisonous in our practice. Okay? Because, first of all, it's the exact opposite of the Dharma mind. Because the Dharma mind is saying that our experiences come from our own mind. And if there's trouble in a relationship, we have to look inside and sort out our own feelings and our own actions, you know, and bear our own responsibility. It's not saying that everything is coming from us. But, you know, we do stop pointing the finger and start becoming introspective. But when we start pointing the finger only now at our teacher, we've just gotten right back into our old mind of it's everybody else's fault that I'm not happy. Isn't it? It's the same old mind. Same old mind. You know, finally I met the Buddha in the form of my teacher. You know, and then we have all these expectations. You know, like they're supposed to be perfect. Well, what does perfect mean? It means they do what I want them to do when I want them to do it. Okay, great definition of perfect, isn't it? You know, it means they fulfill my self-centered thought. Well, what starts happening when our teacher stops fulfilling our self-centered thought? Then we get angry at them and we get disillusioned and we say, you're not acting like a Buddha because you're not doing what I think you should be doing. Yeah? And so we just get really stuck in our own negative mind. And so what happens is we create a lot of negative karma because our mind is being, you know, having a critical, judgmental, you know, feast. And also when we do that, we start, you know, if we lose faith in the person who taught us the Dharma, then it's very easy to lose faith in the Dharma as well. And if we lose faith in the Dharma, you know, we shouldn't lose faith in the Dharma just if the teacher does something we don't like. But ordinary beings tend to confuse the teacher and the teachings. That's a mistake on our part. But if we lose faith in the teachings and stop practicing, who is it that gets hurt from that? You know, our teacher doesn't get hurt from that. Nobody else gets hurt. We're the one. Like I said, we're shooting ourselves in the foot when that happens. So that's why it's very important to really maintain a positive attitude towards our teachers. Now, how is that possible to do? Well, one thing is, you know, our opinions aren't always accurate. You know, I mean, can you imagine that? That maybe sometimes our opinions are inaccurate? Is that possible? You know, is it possible that maybe I'm judging somebody else on the basis of my own personal preferences, not on the basis of what they're doing? Okay, so to keep a good relationship with our teacher, it means we have to start looking at ourselves, our preferences, our expectations, our opinions, and how we project all of those outward. Okay? So the relationship with the teacher becomes very precious in that regard because the teacher is the person who we trust the most, you know, and who we chose because we checked out their qualifications and we were the ones who decided that, yes, you know, they have what it takes to lead us on the path. So, you know, we chose that. And they've been our teacher's been incredibly kind to us, teaching us the Dharma. Like I was saying last night, our parents gave us this body, which is incredible kindness. But our parents can't lead us to enlightenment. They can't teach us the Dharma. So the kindness of, you know, our Dharma teachers who actually teach us is something quite remarkable that you can't even put into words. And yet here we are, you know, coming from this where we started off, having so much confidence and faith in a person, and now all of a sudden the opinion factory is working overtime, you know, and the judgment factory is getting the greatest gross national product ever, because we're just churning out judgments one after the other, and you know our preferences are on an all-time high, okay, winning the Olympic race to the end, you know, speedy preferences, and so here we are doing our same old trips, aren't we? You know, same old trips that we do with everybody else in our life. Okay, projecting our faults onto them, blaming them for our problems, saying that they betrayed us, saying that they disappointed us, the same old things that we do towards sentient beings, now we're doing towards our teacher. Now, the thing that makes this whole thing very precious is that, you know, our teacher isn't just some ordinary sentient being, because we've checked out their qualities and we've determined that they're a qualified spiritual master. So then when our opinion, judgment, and preference factory starts working overtime, we have to say, wait a minute, you know, I already decided this about this person, and what in the world's going on in my mind that now all of a sudden I have such a negative attitude? And then we start to look and we see, wow, the same old emotional trips that I do with other people in my life, I'm doing here with my teacher. Okay? And that makes us stop. Because there's what is it, cognitive dissonance. You know, because there's somebody that we already recognized as being exceptional, and now we're seeing them as negative. So what's going on? Okay? So then we have to start working with our judgments and preferences and opinions and applying all the Dharma teachings that we've learned to sort all of that out, you know. And as we do that, then we're able to restore our positive attitude towards our spiritual mentor. Okay. And in this whole process, you know, our teacher hasn't changed qualities. But we begin to see how, you know, we project this and we project that and then we project this. And it's like the perfect opportunity, because our teacher really is somebody that we can trust. It's a perfect opportunity to really oppose the judgmental, fault-picking mind. And if we can do that with our teacher, who is somebody really who has good qualities, then that's very good practice so that we can start doing it with other people in our lives. Are you getting what I'm saying? Is this making some sense to you? Okay. So, okay, let me give you some examples. Yeah. Take Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Yeah, Rinpoche is a night person. He doesn't sleep. Nobody's ever seen him lie down. You know, for maybe a half an hour, he'll sit in meditation position like this, and he's actually, you know, absorbed all the winds in the central channel. And then he'll just, like, perk up and start doing his morning prayer. So, you know, so he doesn't sleep. He has no need of sleep. His body doesn't get tired. Rinpoche loves the evening. He loves to start teaching around 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. You know, he'll go all night and he'll stop at 5 or 6 in the morning. Okay? Me, I am a morning person. Okay, I get up at 4 o'clock, that's okay. 5 o'clock, that's great. Stay up until 4 or 5 and I'm a mess. Okay? Because I'm grouchy and I'm tired and I want to go to bed. Okay, so I'm a morning person, Rinpoche's an evening person, Rinpoche's giving the teachings. Guess who's boss in the situation? Not me. Okay, so there I am, I go to teachings, and I have all these good reasons why Rinpoche should not teach at night. Because it's not only me falling asleep, it's other people falling asleep. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could all stay awake while you were teaching? And it's so disrespectful to fall asleep in the middle of teachings. You know, so the teaching should be held at a reasonable hour so that, you know, we don't generate so much negative karma falling asleep in the middle of them. And, you know, and you can pay so much better attention. And if you start at the time you say you're going to start, then people don't waste time hanging around, waiting until 9 o'clock when you thought it was going to start at 7. And I have my whole, I mean, I can build a whole court case on this, you know, about why it is really more important, more suitable to start teachings in the morning, get to bed at a good time, get up early in the morning, and live a nice, balanced, healthy life. Okay? I have all the right reasons. Many people agree with me. Does that matter? No. Okay? Doesn't matter beans. Yeah. And, you know, the point is, I mean, it's very clear to me that Rinpoche has realizations. He must have some reason to teach when everybody's falling asleep. There must be some reason, you know. I mean, Rinpoche is not an idiot. You know, there's some reason for this. Yeah, I don't know what the reason is, but there must be some reason. It could be that, who knows, okay? But you see what I'm doing, because I can get myself all worked up and in a very negative state of mind. And it has nothing to do with what Rinpoche's doing. Absolutely nothing to do with him. It's all coming from me. You know, my court case is my court case. Okay? So it's, you know, a very good opportunity for me to say, whoa, you know, okay, I don't understand what's going on, but I trust what he's doing. And I'll do my best to stay awake, and if I really feel I can't, then I'll make the choice not to go, and I'll bear the results of that. Okay? But, you know, so it was a really good thing to stop projecting all my views and opinions about how things should be onto my teacher, you know? Rinpoche also, you know, another thing that drives me totally nuts is, you know, Tibetans have this thing of, you know, they sometimes throw mos, yeah, they have dice, and they make a prayer to Pelden Lama, one of the Dharma protectors, and they'll ask a question and throw the dice, and then according to the dice, you find out, you know, if you should do this or do that or do this or do that. So some lamas don't use the mos at all. Some lamas use them a little bit. Some lamas use them a lot. Okay, Rinpoche is one of the ones who uses them a lot. He'll use a mo to decide what to serve for lunch. Okay, so he will. You know, other lamas would never do that. Okay, this is how he chooses what to serve his guests for lunch. Well, you know, it totally drives me nuts because, you know, it's like, if I come and ask a question, I want Rinpoche's idea. You know, somehow the dice, it doesn't do it for me. You know, I can understand, you know, for Tibetans. Because, you know, if you're Tibetan and, you know, oh, yeah. With a Tibetan, you say, oh, yeah, the guru's the Buddha, but actually I want Pelden Lama's opinion. You know, and then the guru, you know, channels that or whatever and does the dice. For a Tibetan, that works and it inspires faith. For me, it doesn't inspire faith. It inspires doubt. Okay, and like, why do we have to wait for the menu to cook until Rinpoche has done a mo? I mean, and, you know, there was a time period I would get so worked up and annoyed about this, you know, especially when you're trying to run a Dharma center, and one day you're, you know, it's, you know, buy this property, and the next day it's, no, don't buy that one, buy this one, and then the next day it's like, rent this one, and, you know, everything's changing all the time. You know, and you're just trying to, like, you know, grasp on to inherently existent security. And your teacher's making everything change all the time. You know, so I can watch my mind, I mean, just go completely ballistic about this. And, you know, again, I have my whole court case about how it's impractical and it raises money and the resources could be put to better use instead of changing all the time, and why can't we develop our own wisdom, and, you know, Lama said develop your own wisdom, why isn't Rinpoche letting us do that instead of throwing the dice, and, you know, and I can go on and on and write a book about it. Okay, does it matter? No. okay? And so I would sit there and get like outrageously angry. And yet here's somebody who was, it was very clear to me, I mean, Rinpoche is no ordinary person, and his teachings are totally magnificent. And without his kindness, I would even hate to think of where I would be and what would happen to me. And so somehow I had to come to terms with this. And it was actually, I struggled with it for years and years and years and years, you know. And I finally had to come to the conclusion that different people do things in different ways. You know, it's like a very simple conclusion, but I really had to struggle with that. And it's like, okay, for some people, throwing Mo's works. It doesn't work for me. It's okay that it doesn't work for me, and it's also okay that it works for them. Not everybody has to do things the way I do it. I don't have to do things the way other people do it, you know? And to really get my mind so it could, like, encompass that and give people space to do things in their own way, in the way that works for them, you know, it was a real big thing for me. And like I said, if you can do it with your teacher, then it sets the stage to be able to do it with other people. Okay? And so it's really helped me. I mean, I saw an example of how that whole struggle with my teacher helped me. Well, I was talking to you last night about the Catholic Buddhist Nuns Conference that I just came from. Well, in that conference, when we were having the discussion about justice, okay, we were having a lot of talk about, well, how is it best to help sentient beings? And it blew my mind that some of the Catholic nuns were critical of Mother Teresa for her work because she didn't try and change the social structures that perpetrated poverty. You know? So we had this whole huge discussion, is the best way to benefit by giving food and medical care, or is it better to benefit by changing the social structures and being politically active? And then some of the Buddhist nuns, we were saying, well, actually, it's better to subdue our own mind and develop spiritual realizations to really be able to benefit others. So there were all these different ways of being of service and benefit to others. And I could see that some people were, you know, in our group were really struggling with that. It was like they really wanted everybody to do it their way. And I could see that in my mind, I really respected the fact that everybody else has different qualities, different talents. It's up to us as a unique individual to find our special way of contributing to the world. And we need everybody doing all the different works, and we can't say one is more important than the other. Okay? And so just in seeing that I was able to maintain that mind state that was accepting of what everybody else was doing while some people were struggling with it, when I look back, how was I able to get, you know, to have that idea rather naturally? It was because I had spent all those years struggling with the issue with my teacher about why doesn't he do things the way I think they should be done? And do I have to do things the way he does them in order to be a good student? And I realized, no, you know, my teachers can like Tibetan tea, and I think that stuff stinks. And that has nothing to do with whether we have a good relationship as spiritual mentor and disciple. You know, there's possible to have differences of opinions with people, but without having resentment and competition and disharmonious speech and all that stuff. You know? And I began to realize, yeah, you know, okay, on some issues I have different opinions than my teachers, or I do things different ways. Well, you know what? I was talking about Lama Tsering Khyentse and Atisha yesterday. Lama Tsering Khyentse had the Chittamatra view of emptiness. Atisha had the Majjhimika view of emptiness. They had different views of emptiness. And actually, Atisha's view was considered the higher view. But Atisha had so much respect for his spiritual master that whenever he spoke his teacher's name, he would always put his hands together, and sometimes he would even rinse his mouth out before saying his teacher's name. That's the kind of devotion he had for Sirlingpa. And they had a difference of opinion on not whether butter tea is good for you and not whether Mo's work or not, but they had an important difference of opinion, which is the correct view of emptiness. That's a very important issue, okay? And yet, you know, Atisha had total, you know, faith in Lama Sirlingpa and gratitude towards his teacher, and was able to tolerate that, yes, we have a difference of opinions. Okay? So just, you know, in my own judgmental mind, for me to be able to crack that open a little bit and tolerate differences, you know, through struggling over the issue with my teacher, has enabled me to start to do it more and more with other people in my life. Okay? It hasn't been easy. I mean, it was pretty difficult for a number of years, but I hung in there. You know, and that's Tom's mother, Sarah, has this slogan, just keep showing up. And, you know, and that's what you do. And eventually, if you do, you work everything out. Okay? So that's just some kind of example for you, maybe, of how the mentor-disciple relationship is something unique and special, and the kind of benefit an advantage that you can't get out of it, but also just really pointing out that it's something that we have to hang in there with and work with our own mind. Okay? But if we do, you know, it can be quite remarkable. Yeah? Because believe me, I mean, every time I watch and my mind is like projecting blah, 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 I realize, hey, this is the same thing I'm projecting on my teacher. It's like, hey, this is what I do with everybody else in my life. And Dharma is about changing my mind, not criticizing everybody else and telling them how they should change. Yeah? So it kind of keeps throwing you back on yourself. You know? Sometimes, you know, you think, can't it just be somebody else's fault for a while, you know? Can't I, you know, it's like so comforting to be a victim, you know? Because if you're a victim, you don't have to do anything except complain. You know, you don't have to take responsibility, you don't have to change your mind, you don't have to think things through, you don't have to admit that maybe your perceptions are distorted. All you can do is sit there and whine and say everybody else should change. You know, it's so nice to be a victim, isn't it? Well, is it? Yeah, it's actually pretty miserable, isn't it? It's terribly miserable. Okay, but if we're going to start taking responsibilities for our opinions and projections and preferences and everything else, then, you know, we have to work with our mind, and then we can stop that victim mentality and stop the pauvre de me, you know, mantra. Okay? Okay, so that's a little bit more about, you know, the relationship with the spiritual mentor. In the Lan Rim, it talks about how our spiritual mentors really have been the kindest people to us. And at first that seems rather strange, you know, especially in America, because we come to Dharma teachings, we approach Dharma teachings the way we approach everything else, with our consumer mind, you know, and our mind of what can I get out of this. And a relationship with a spiritual mentor, you know, if we approach it with what can I get out of it, then we're doing it, you know, exactly what we do with everything else in our life, looking out for our own benefit. And then, you know, our teacher's job is to satisfy us and what we want. But, you know, our teacher's job is to lead us to enlightenment. So it, you know, we have to remold our mind so it's not this, you know, consumer mind, of, you know, I paid my money, give me my goods. Yeah. But really seeing that there's a lot more going on than meets the eye. Yeah, that we have to work with over a period of time. Okay. But seeing the kindness of our spiritual mentors really involves what I've been talking about the last couple of days when I say talk about the big view. Okay? In other words, if we just have the small view of this lifetime and me and my problems and how can I feel better, we're not going to see our teacher's kindness so much. You know, well, maybe a little bit, but not so much. But if we really think about what cyclic existence means and what it means to be stuck with a mind and a body that are under the influence of ignorance, anger, and hostility, okay, and clinging attachment, what does that really mean? And what does it mean to take one rebirth after another, getting born in all these different life forms and going through all these different experiences and, you know, having so much fear and dying again and again and being born again and again and not having control over our situation? And we see what a horror, you know, samsara is. The more we can get a feeling for that, then the more we appreciate the person who tells us how to get out of samsara. Okay? But if we don't really see the situation we're in as something unsatisfactory, if we, you know, are just wanting to tweak samsara a little bit to make it better, yeah, if we just want to practice dharma so that I can be happier right now and so that I can learn to manipulate people better by putting on a smile and pretending to be nice, or so that I, you know, whatever it is, then we're not really going to appreciate what it means for somebody to give us the Buddhist teachings. Okay, but the more we get that feeling of samsara, the more we get a feeling of what Buddha potential is, and, you know, that our human lives have more value and meaning than just, you know, making money and having a career and dying, that, you know, the person who shows us a deeper and greater meaning to our life, you know, there's something special going on there. You know, and it's a kindness that other people haven't shown us. Okay, so what the relationship with our teacher does is it also opens us up to recognize the kindness of others. Okay, because again, the kindness of our teacher is something special. If we can't see the kindness of our teachers, how are we going to see the kindness of ordinary sentient beings who don't do for us what our teachers do for us? Yeah? You see what I mean? If we can't see the kindness of somebody who's showing us the path to the greatest happiness, how are we going to see the kindness of ordinary sentient beings with all their flaws and mistakes? Okay. If we can't see the kindness of others, what kind of mental state are we going to live in? It's hell, isn't it? Yeah? I think hell is when we can't see kindness. I mean, think about it in your life. When you've had the most suffering in your life, isn't it because somehow, I mean, your mind was in hell, and what's the quality of that hellish mind is we don't see any kindness. Yeah. So I think this whole thing, you know, that's emphasized in the teachings again and again and again about seeing the kindness of others, appreciating how interconnected we are, appreciating what others have done for us and given us. That's such an important quality to develop as a spiritual practitioner. You know? And it's so opposite our usual habitual way, isn't it? Because our usual habitual way is, I've been so kind to other people. I've done this for you, and I've done that for you, and I've gone out of my way for you, and I've bought this for you, and I've been inconvenienced by you, and I've done so many things for you, and look how you treat me. Okay, we're masters of that, aren't we? Yeah? Is some of this resonating? Anybody here act like that? You know? It's like our view is, you know, the world is so privileged to have me in it. You know, here I am this wonderful, charming, talented, fantastic person who is so magnanimous, so generous, doing everything for everybody. And look how they treat me. They talk behind my back. They criticize me. They gossip about me. They rip me off. They betray my trust. And I am so kind and do so much for wonderful things for all these people. I mean, this is our line, isn't it? Yeah? True or not true? Some people are sitting there very stone-faced. I don't know. Okay, I will own it. This is my line. Maybe some of you don't have this problem. You know, maybe you're already very highly advanced practitioners. But I have this difficulty, you know? Because nobody ever appreciates me enough. Nobody loves me enough. Nobody does enough for me. Yeah, I mean, especially in consideration of how much I do for other people. You know, so we live our life. I live my life. You know? With I'm so kind and, oh, look how you repay it. Okay, that mind is hell. Okay? And it's a dead end. Spiritually, you cannot practice Dharma with that mind. Yeah? That mind that cannot see the kindness and cannot recognize our interconnectedness, it's impossible for that mind to practice Dharma because that mind is continually projecting negative out on everybody and everything else. When we project negativity and faults, what kind of karma are we creating? Are we abandoning ignorance, anger, and attachment, or are we increasing them? When we're projecting negative qualities out on everybody and everything. It's very clear, you know, we cannot practice Dharma, really, and make any spiritual progress with that mind that cannot acknowledge kindness and the mind that only complains about how others treat us and how unfair it is. That's the thing we learn as kids. This is unfair. Yeah, the world owes me something. I am entitled to something better. Okay? It becomes really, we block ourselves off so much when we have that attitude. So how do we get over this? Well, we start again with our spiritual teacher, our spiritual mentor, because that person has really shown us the greatest kindness that's possible. And so we train our mind to see the kindness that they've shown us and to develop a sense of gratitude and appreciation for it. And we start opening our heart to be able to feel gratitude and appreciation. You know? Because many times, I mean, we have such a difficult time feeling gratitude and appreciation and love, don't we? You know, sometimes we really have emotional constipation. And, you know, so we need to learn to open our hearts in that way. So we start with our teacher. We can see the kindness of our teacher. Then we can start going to the kindness of friends and kindness of strangers. And then the extraordinary kindness of our enemies and the people who harm us. Okay, so you can see how if you want to develop bodhicitta, you know, that mind that aspires for enlightenment, for the benefit of all sentient beings, we have to see other sentient beings as lovable. To see them as lovable, we have to see them as kind. Okay, so we have to be able to experience gratitude, and we have to really see how interconnected we are, how we dependent we are on others for every aspect of our life. You know, physically staying alive, learning to speak, learning to walk, learning anything in life, we're dependent on others. Okay? So to generate bodhicitta, we need to see that kindness. We need to be able to experience gratitude and appreciation. And to do that for sentient beings who have faults, first of all, we have to be able to do it in terms of our spiritual mentors who have far fewer faults and who have far greater kindness to us. Okay? Is this making some sense to you, how it works? Yeah? And really, you know, that this whole ability to let ourselves feel appreciation and indebtedness and kindness, okay? I think it's really a blessing to be able to feel those emotions, a sense of gratitude. Because when we have a sense of gratitude, you know, we see kindness everywhere with us. Yeah? Many of you know Miriam, okay? Miriam, our lovely, she's got to be 85, 86, 87-year-old woman, you know, who's been coming to DFF for ages. I had lunch with her today.
Oh, wow.
Okay? Miriam is gradually losing it, you know? But she has this total joy around her. And she keeps saying, my life is so blessed. My life is so blessed. People are so wonderful and so kind to me. You know? So even though she's forgetful and she can't hear what you're saying and, you know, whatever's going on, her attitude is so positive because she sees the kindness of others and she feels grateful for everything she has. You know? And I was thinking, you know, after I saw her today, what's more important, that you have all your intelligence or you have this heart of gratitude? You know, if you're an old person and let's say you're not senile at all and you have all your intelligence, but if you don't have a heart of gratitude, wow, you're going to be miserable and you create a lot of misery. Okay? But even if you lose it, and you can't remember, your short-term memory is shot. But if you have a sense of gratitude towards others, then you spread joy in the world. And your life becomes meaningful, and your mind is happy. You know, I mean, it's such an incredible teaching. So I think that ability, you know, to open our heart and gratitude and appreciation is so important, you know. And to completely get over that mind that says, I've done so much for you, how come you aren't reciprocating? You know, because we make so many of our relationships with other people a business deal, don't we? Yeah, I'll give to you, but you have to give to me. And if you don't give to me, I'm not giving to you. So you love me, then I'll love you. And if you don't love me as much as I want you to love me, then I'm not going to love you as much as, you know, we make it a business deal. And we take the joy out of love. Okay? Because I think the whole thing about loving us, others, is in the process of loving. It's the process of opening our heart and feeling affection and kindness. And that is the joy from it. If we're thinking the joy is receiving love, we're setting ourselves up for disappointment and we're leading ourselves into a dead-end road. You know? Because if our happiness comes from receiving love and not from giving love, then, you know, we're always going to have this mentality if nobody ever gives me enough love. You know? And that's hell, isn't it? Whereas if the joy in our life becomes in the sharing of love, then it doesn't matter if somebody reciprocates or doesn't reciprocate. You know? And, you know, again, I watch my teachers for an example for this. I mean, they give so much to other people. And the way other people treat them, oh my goodness, sometimes it's really amazing. Yeah, but my teachers don't get depressed. I mean, they're disciples. We do such outrageous things. But the teachers don't get depressed. You know, why? Because their joy is in benefiting others, not in receiving love and honor and respect and property. Okay?
It's the joy that comes just from opening our heart and offering. Okay? And I think it was that same joy that enabled Mother Teresa to do what she did. You know, because all those dying people aren't going to go, "Oh, wow, Mother Teresa, you're so fantastic." You know? I mean, they're sitting there dying. They're involved in their own internal process. But for her, the joy was in giving. Okay? And so this really, I think it's a very basic point in the Dharma, is that the joy is in the giving. Yeah? And to train our mind to take joy in that giving without expecting results and without waiting for reciprocation. Because if we can give without strings attached, then we're never going to feel like somebody's taken advantage of us. You know, think about it. When we say so-and-so's taken advantage of me, there's somehow we have in our mind, there's some business thing. If I've given so much and they haven't reciprocated, and so we call that they've taken advantage of me. But when we stop measuring what the other person has given back and our joy comes just from giving, then I don't think there's ever the feeling of they've taken advantage of me. I mean, one little glimpse where I'm starting to see this is in, I do prison work. Okay, so I work with all these inmates. Not all these inmates, it's actually quite just a very small number of them. Yeah, and you work with them, and then sometimes they get out of prison and you never hear from them again. Now, I could do this big thing of, I wrote so many letters, and I was so supportive, and I did this and sent them this and that, and look at it, they get out of prison, and they can't even write a card and tell me they got released with their new address. They just disappear. I could look at it that way, or I could look at it and say, wow, they taught me so much, and I really wish them well as they re-enter society, and I think some of what I gave them they'll remember and they'll find useful. And it doesn't matter if the relationship continues or not, because I was able to help them during the time when they were suffering greatly in prison. And maybe there isn't the opportunity to continue the relationship now when they're out of prison, but that's okay. I was able to help them when they were in prison. Okay? So, you know, if I'm able to look at it that way, and the joy is in giving and the joy is in what I learned from them, then, if they don't write to me afterwards, that's okay. Okay? Getting what I mean? You know? So this kind of thing, and this is really, you know, a process of training our mind in bodhicitta. You know? How to give without expectations. Okay? Now, again, giving without expectations doesn't mean you give foolishly. Yeah? Doesn't mean you become what I call a Mickey Mouse bodhisattva. Yeah. Okay. You still have to assess situations and give when it's appropriate and give what's appropriate. And sometimes the best gift is to say no. Okay. But you know, the joy is in the act, not in fulfilling, getting our expectations fulfilled. And sometimes we don't even realize we have the expectations until afterwards we're miserable. You know, oh, I did so much and then they treated me like this. And then, oh, well, what was my expectation in there? Well, my expectation was, you know, they should at least treat me with, you know, two thank yous. Or whatever it is. Okay, anyway, I'm getting, you know, a lot of different topics are all coming in under this topic of how to relate to a spiritual mentor. Okay, I mean, we've talked about appreciation and generosity and anger and, you know, all sorts of different things. It's kind of all coming in here. But what I'd like to do now is give you some time for questions and comments. Yes.
You said
Okay. So she's saying that, you know, I said that we start looking at the kindness of our spiritual teachers and then go on to see the kindness of others. What happens if we don't yet have a spiritual teacher? You can still see the kindness of others. Yeah? Yeah, you can still, I mean, we can still train ourselves to see the kindness of other beings. I think it's a little bit easier if we start with our teachers. But if you don't have a teacher yet, you can still look around, you know, think of the kindness of our parents, the kindness of the people who give us a job, the kindness of our friends, the kindness of the people who made this building that we're meeting in. Okay? The kindness of the people who make the roads that we drive on. We can still see kindness. It's all around us. Yeah? And then slowly, you know, when the time's right and you meet a spiritual mentor, you know, or take somebody as your spiritual mentor, then you can also add on that practice of seeing the kindness of your spiritual mentor. You can see the kindness of the Buddha. You don't have a spiritual mentor, see the kindness of the Buddha. I mean, read something about the Buddha's life, about what the Buddha put up with, you know, in order to teach the Dharma that's come down to us this day. Yeah, we can really see the kindness of the Buddha. Yeah.
When you were talking about the woman who is losing her mind, I was thinking of actually my grandmother, who is still has full facility but has a very pained heart, and trying to think of something I could do for her, but what was arising was maybe not helpful. Anyway, I would like some advice, if you can give me some advice, because I think she's reaching the end of her chance in this life, and I would like to offer her something, for certainly she has offered me a lot.
Yeah.
But
how do you do it?
But without any kind of judgment, without any kind of she needs something and I have any idea what it is. I don't know what it is.
Okay. So the question is, you know, that I was talking about Marian and how she has a joyful heart and despite, you know, the senility. And she's saying that her grandmother is very alert, but her heart is quite closed. And you're saying you would really like to be able to offer something to your grandma to help loosen the pain, yeah? And how to do that. Okay, sometimes the people who have grown old and have become bitter as they've grown old, it's a sorrowful thing. And I think the best thing to do is just to show them love, you know? I love you even though you complain. Yeah, and we don't say that. But, you know, we can still love them even when they complain, you know. And if you find their complaining difficult, change the topic. Yeah? Or sometimes, there's all sorts of different ways how to actively listen to somebody and acknowledge their pain. You have to see, you know, sometimes the best way to help is acknowledge their pain. Sometimes the best way to help is because you see that they're just telling the same story they tell 20 times a day, is to change the subject and not talk about it. Okay? So you have to see what the situation is and how best to handle it. But sometimes just being a joyful, relaxed person yourself is a tremendous gift to the people that you come in contact with. You know, and you go to your grandmother and hug her. Yeah? And it doesn't matter she's complaining. Doesn't matter she smells. You go and hug her. You know? We were all lined up with Miriam today to get hugged. You know? And she was hugging all of us. And, you know, so you become a hugger. And you do small things, you know, do small things. Give her a cup of tea. Give her, do small things for people who are suffering a lot like that. Yeah. They can see it. Here's a question.
The beginning of your story, you are finally realized that different people could do different things. So you say that. So if you could tell us a little bit how, after you did realize that, that some way, like a process, what did you do completely? Like you pray for something, or you talk to your teacher, or whatever, how did you
realize it? So I had said that I got to the point where I could really accept that different people did things in different ways. So you're saying, how did I get to that point? I opened my eyes and saw what the reality was. The reality is, people do things differently. It was like I didn't have to try and see something special that wasn't there. What I had to do is get rid of all my opinions so I could see what the reality of the situation is, which is everybody's very different and everybody thinks different and everybody has different ways of doing things. And I had to really like, okay, let's look at reality. It doesn't matter what I think reality should be. It doesn't matter that I think everybody should do things my way because my way is best. What I think doesn't matter beats, you know, because what I think has nothing to do with what is. And what right now I'm having problems because I'm refusing what is. And instead of accepting that this flower is orange, I'm wanting the flower to be blue. You know, and I can want it to be blue all I want to, it's still going to be orange. If I let go of wanting it to be blue and look at it and say it's orange, then my mind can be peaceful. Okay? So for me, you know, just accepting the differences and different dispositions, different interests, different ways of doing things, you know, it for me it was really a matter of letting go of my ideas. Can you imagine that? My wonderful, perfect ideas that if only the world used, it would be what? It would be good. I have so many good ideas and suggestions and advice. And, you know, George Bush doesn't take them. Donald Rumsfeld doesn't take them. I mean, can you imagine my wondrous ideas? These idiots don't appreciate them. You know, so it's just real life, you know, get rid of my ideas and my preferences. They, you know, they aren't in line with what is. Yeah? Carrie.
Hi, everyone. It was about when you're talking. I was first going to thank you for publicly letting me disagree with you. The reason is because, modesty aside, I feel that I have gotten to the point where I can actually really accept that other people have different ideas. Mm-hmm. The problem is that most of the time when I do that, I go into this enemy and foe. So it is they have a it's okay that they have a different idea, but I disconnect with them emotionally, or because they don't think like me, therefore I can't find anything that is really connecting to the best in that person. So even when I had doubts about the Dharma, I felt like because the Dharma wasn't 100% agreeing with me, I wasn't welcome. And so it took me a long time to go to the point where I don't have to agree with anything and I'm still welcome. So I think that it's the one more step. And when you said that these two, the teacher and the disciple, were able to disagree on that, I felt this peace.
Yeah.
Very happy.
Yeah.
They can do that. I can do that too.
Yeah.
I feel very connected.
Yeah. Exactly. The connection. Thank you very much for saying that, because connection does not mean that we have to agree on everything. Okay. Will somebody please remember this and remind me of it? Because people disagree with it. But it's really true. You know, being connected doesn't mean we have to agree on everything. Yeah.
I was wondering, with the establishing of the monastic tradition in the West, Is there any analogy between the relationship between the spiritual mentor and the disciple, and then the monastic community and the lay community? Is there any way of drawing any sort of analogy there in those relationships?
Okay, so is there a way of drawing an analogy between, we're talking about the spiritual mentor and the student, and then the monastic community and the lay community? Interesting question. Well, one thing is, I think, you know, a lot of times our spiritual mentors come from the monastic community, because those are the people who've had the chance to really dedicate their lives to the Dharma and, you know, really practice intensively. Yeah, but you know, there can be lay teachers too. I think with the spiritual community, with the Sangha, and when I see Sangha here, I don't mean people who come to a Dharma center. You know, it's in the traditional sense of the monastic community. I think what the Sangha has to offer is the example of people who are really trying hard to live in pure ethical discipline. And I think that, you know, as I was saying about, like, looking at how our teacher handles situations and learning from that, sometimes it can be very beneficial to look at how the Sangha handles situations and how they apply the ethical discipline, how they learn the teachings and apply the teachings to their life. And that can sometimes be an example for the rest of society. Actually, I think, you know, that's a really important function that the Sangha has, is to show an example to society of people who are really trying to integrate the Dharma. So it doesn't mean that monastics as individuals are perfect, okay? It doesn't mean that we always keep our vows 100%, you know, whatever. But, you know, I think that we're trying. And I think just the process of hanging in there and trying can set an example for the rest of society about how to hang in there and try, and how to try and work out differences, and how to try and create community and communicate with each other. Yeah. So I think in that way, yeah, there is some analogy that goes on. Another aspect of the analogy is sometimes we have incredible projections on monastics. In the same way that we have projections on our spiritual mentors, and we expect them to be able to read our minds, and we expect them to be able to levitate, and we expect them never to get sick because after all they're Buddhas, or, you know, we have all sorts of unrealistic expectations of our spiritual mentors. Sometimes we have those same kinds of things of the Sangha community. And then, you know, and then we're kind of shocked when, you know, the Sangha spends money in a way that we don't think they should spend the money. Okay, you know, they buy a Buddha statue and we think they should spend it on, you know, offering food to the poor and needy. Okay, and then our judgmental mind kind of chips in and, you know, criticize, instead of just realizing, hey, you know, different people have different values, or different cultures have different values. And accept some kind of difference existing there. Okay. I know for myself, I remember when I was a baby nun, okay, talking about having projections on the Sangha. I was a baby nun and I was living at Kopan, and I walked into the Sangha dining room once, and there was a monk reading Newsweek magazine, and I was totally scandalized. You know, you're a monk. I didn't say this out loud. He was senior to me. But, you know, you're a monk, and you're reading that rubbish about politics and sports, and how dare you read that? You're wasting your precious human rebirth. You should be in your room meditating on compassion for all these people. You know, I mean, my judgmental mind, poof, you know, just how horrible, you're reading a news magazine. You know, now dare I tell you that, you know, sometimes I read Newsweek or Time or something. But, you know, I had to, again, realize over time that there's a variety of different motivations that people can have for reading Newsweek. And it doesn't have to be a waste of time. I mean, if you're teaching the Dharma, you have to know what's going on in the world so you can make examples of things. You know, and you can read the Newsweek magazine with a mind of attachment and hostility, or you could read the Newsweek magazine with a mind that's seeing karma at every turn, because it's an incredible book about karma. Okay, karma and its results. I mean, marvelous. And so, you know, there was an example of where I had a negative projection on a Sangha member or on the Sangha community, and having to sit there and work with it and realize, hey, okay, I may not like to read that magazine, but somebody else could read it with a good motivation. You know, and somebody else may learn something that they can use to benefit others, you know, when they're teaching the Dharma. And, you know, it's not really my business. Yeah? But I don't have to have an opinion about everything everybody does and everything everybody reads. Okay? Yeah?
What kind of work are you doing in the prisons?
What kind of work am I doing in the prisons? I do whatever is there in front of my nose to do. I don't really think about it a lot. People write me, you know, I mean, I get addresses for people. I have no idea how they get my address. And whatever they ask for, I respond. So sometimes they ask for books. Sometimes they ask for tapes. Sometimes they've been trying to practice and they have a question about practice. Sometimes they want to know, you know, what the difference between different Buddhist traditions are. So whatever it is that they write me about, then I respond to that. And some of the inmates, you know, over time, you know, some correspondences are very short. You know, I'll send them a book and I'll say, if you have any questions, please feel free to write. And they don't write, you know, that's okay. Then other people will write and we'll get into a whole discussion, you know, about different things about life or different things, you know, it's very often about what's going on in their mind, what their situation is, how they, what their life was all about and why they made the choices that they made and what the results of their choices are. So a lot of it's done through correspondence, and then it's also, you know, I will go into prison. So I was saying yesterday that I had done a prison visit to Monroe yesterday afternoon, and last month I was at San Quentin. And, you know, over the summer I'm going to be going to two prisons in Ohio and maybe one in Wisconsin. You know, so it's just kind of like whoever is there, whatever they ask, if I can go and do something, I do it. Yeah? Sometimes I've given refuge and precepts or bodhisattva vows in prisons, and that is an incredibly powerful experience. I mean, I remember the first time when I gave refuge in the five precepts to somebody who had killed somebody, you know? Or you give refuge in the five precepts to somebody who, you know, was an alcoholic or was, you know, a drug addict. It's a real powerful experience. Yeah. Or you do the bodhisattva ceremony in a prison where the environment is so filled with hostility. It's very, very powerful. Yeah, Stephen does prison work too, and he can tell you some stories. Yeah? Yeah. And you really learn much more from these people than you teach. You know, the same with hospice work. Tom does hospice work. And you know, you learn much more from the people than you give them. Yeah, it's really a gift. Yeah.
Yesterday you talked about humility.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yesterday I spoke about humility. How do you cultivate humility? Okay, well, one thing, let's put humility in perspective, especially because not everybody was here yesterday. We often in life, we assume that if a person is proud, that they're self-confident. And we assume that if a person is humble, that they have low self-esteem. This is not correct. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. If a person is arrogant and proud, it's generally because they don't have self-confidence. because when we really have self-confidence, we don't need to go around telling everybody how wonderful we are and doing power trips over people. Similarly, if we have low self-esteem, we often mask it by being proud, don't we? You know, when we don't believe in ourselves, how do we cover up for it? We act like we're a big shot. So actually, low self-esteem and pride go together, and humility and self-confidence go together. Because if you're really self-confident, then you can be humble. Because you really believe in yourself, so you don't need to prove yourself to anybody. Okay? So how do we cultivate humility? I think one aspect of that is really training ourselves to see others' kindness towards us, to see how much we have been the recipient of kindness, everything from people teaching us how to tie our shoelaces to how to talk to how to eat, you know. When we really start thinking about everything everybody has given us, even strangers, what they've done, all the people who worked in the public utility board who make it so we can have electricity. You know, when we really feel their kindness towards us, then a certain kind of humility comes because we recognize, hey, it's not all about me. No, I happen to be incredibly fortunate and the recipient of great kindness. And the world isn't about what I give to it and how grateful they should be for me, but the world is really about how much kindness there is and how I can feel grateful to the world. And then that helps us to cultivate a certain aspect of humility. Another thing that I find is very good for cultivating humility is challenging my arrogance, okay? So when I start getting puffed up, thinking that, you know, I'm a real big shot, all I have to do is stand in a room and ask myself, could I build this room? Okay, no. Yeah, I don't know anything about architecture. I'm learning. I don't know anything about building. I'm learning that too. I know nothing about electricity except how to flick a switch. Okay? If I look around, I mean, I do not know very much. And if I were the best that the world had to offer, we would be in the Stone Age, folks. You know? I mean, except even below the Stone Age, because I don't even know how to fashion a tool out of a stone. Okay? So this, you know, brings a certain amount of humility. You know, it's like I really don't know a lot, and that's okay, and how fortunate I am that there's other people who do know more than me. Okay? So it brings a certain kind of humility. And I think also humility involves being okay with not having the last word. Yeah? Because we like to have the last word. You know, we like to have the last word two or three times, just in case the person didn't get it the first time that we won the argument. So there's a certain kind of humility that comes from, you know, I don't need to rub it in, and I don't need to show the person I won the argument, and I don't need to make them feel embarrassed or humiliate them. Now, I can just, you know, be humble, just let things go. And that can be an aspect of my way of repaying kindness. Yeah. Let's sit quietly for a few minutes and do some meditation here.